drink, Dot assured him. And it was true. Just a few sips of the whiskey at the restaurant and maybe one drink here over the course of several hours. She was just high on life. Euphoria flooded into her, ripening her valleys, turning her leaves green. But then, she dropped to the floor as though her knees had been chopped off. People laughed and scattered. She tried to stand, but her head lolled on her neck. Vomit rose in her throat. Her legs wobbled, then went out from under her. The last thing she remembered was hearing the bass thudding against the club's floor and noticing feet around her, and a dropped plastic cup, and someone's chewed gum. She woke up in a white bed in a quiet room. Something was beeping next to her, and she could feel a dull ache in her arm. Her first thought was that she'd fallen through a wormhole and was 9 years old again and in the hospital. The room began to take shape. She saw green and white striped curtains, a flat-screen TV on the wall. Out the window, a glimmering pool, palm trees. A man in a white doctor's coat appeared over her. He had a broad nose, wild eyebrows, intense dark eyes. He smelled strongly of aftershave, which turned Dot's stomach.
"Feeling better, Miss Dot?"
he asked in an Indian accent. Dot looked around. "What happened? Where's my boyfriend?"
"Just rest, all right?"
"Where's my mother?" The door opened, and Dorothy rushed in.
"Darling, you're up."
She touched the man's arm, just below his elbow.
"This is Dr. Singh. I had him pop in to check you out."
Dot blinked. She must have fainted last night. From a seizure, surely. Another tumor. She bit down hard on her tongue. Dorothy fluffed a pillow next to Dot.
"You're in my suite, at the Magnolia."
"Is it bad?" Dot whispered.
"Is what bad?"
"The tumor. It's back, right?"
Her aunt's shoulders sank, and she smiled. "Oh, honey."
She pressed her cool hands on Dot's forehead.
"You just had too much to drink last night, that's all."
Dot tried to sit up.
"Are you sure? Maybe we should have me tested. Maybe we should call someone."
Dorothy waved her hand dismissively.
"Just rest. You're dehydrated, that's all. Too much alcohol does that to you. You should be thanking me. Dr. Singh was very kind to come here with all his equipment."
She leaned closer. "That IV will make you feel much better." "Thank you," Dot said robotically. Something felt off. Maybe it was just that she was exhausted, and there was still the residue of fear clinging to her. That tumor pulsed inside her, she knew, still hiding. Those nasty little cells were rearranging, mutating, poisoning her. She still very much believed that.
"And incidentally,"
Dorothy turned away from her and peered at herself in the mirror, fluffing her curls. Dot thought she saw her snake an arm around Dr. Singh's waist, but when she wriggled up higher in the bed, her arms were by her sides.
"Don't mention it to your mother. She was never really one for partying."
She met Dot's eyes in the glass.
"It'll be our little secret."
Eliza.
"What the hell is that?" I ask as I step onto the sidewalk.
Desmond, who has changed from his cape into a shiny-looking button-down, jeans that show exactly how thin his hips are, and a red beret, stands at the passenger door.
"The Batmobile. And you are my Vicky Vale."
I look nothing like Vicky Vale. The garish vehicle is all angles and wings and covered in a cheap-looking matte paint. It has a long front end with a launcher. There are vents on the sides and exaggerated wings at the back and some sort of rocket booster where a tailpipe should be.
"Does it drive?" I ask.
"Naturally."
"And it's yours?"
Desmond opens the passenger door, which flips up like a DeLorean.
"Naturally." Why didn't I see this at my house the other day? It was in the shop, getting new paint, Desmond says. That day, I came on a bike. The car uses a normal key and has a Buick logo on the steering wheel. The dials and readouts are less techy than I thought they'd be. The speedometer's top speed is a tame 130 miles an hour. As we pull away from the curb, people barely give us a glance. It's Venice, though. We could be octopus people in a penis-shaped spaceship and no one would care. Where to? Desmond asks. This office in Westwood. Not far. This morning, I found Leonidas on Facebook. It took some doing. His is a fan page, for one thing, and he lists himself as the only Leonidas you'll ever need to know. He isn't my friend on my fan page, but perhaps he had been on the other page I used to have that disappeared into the ether, if I'm to believe that it existed. He's the only 22-year-old Leonidas lore in Los Angeles. The only one you'll ever need to know, clearly. And thank God his page is public. Naturally, I carefully scrolled back to see if there were phantom pictures of him and me together. The guy has a thing for taking pictures of sunsets, really bad tattoos he spots around town, and his breakfast every morning. But there are none of me. The page says Leonidas works part-time in reception at his father's plastic surgery office in Westwood. It's the same block of office buildings where my mother works, too, as an assistant to a podiatrist. I can picture the Whole Foods down the block with its parking garage and bike racks. I looked up the office number, called it, and heard his voice answer. It jingled bells in my head. That voice had spoken to me. It had said nice things. But had it yelled, too, like in my memory of him? Had it yelled a lot? I touch my temple. An MRI is in the books at a walk-in clinic in Los Feliz that doesn't ask any questions and doesn't take insurance. The schedule was so jam-packed with other people wanting mammograms and bone scans and whatever else that I have to wait 3 weeks. The tumor feels like a foregone conclusion, really. Maybe I don't even need an MRI. After all, what else could have stolen my memory so effectively? I picture the tumor as the Grinch who stole Christmas, chuckling as he stuffed my life experiences in a Santa sack and climbed up the chimney. We drive several mural-riddled Venice blocks in silence. Desmond cruising in his Batmobile, with only one hand on the wheel. This American Life on NPR plays scratchily through the car's speakers. Ira Glass's nasal voice is incongruous in such a vessel. Tell me seriously, I ask Desmond. Did you steal this thing from a museum? Not at all. I got it from an auction a few years ago. Didn't it cost a fortune? He gives me a saucy smile. I had a small inheritance. What a stupid thing to spend money on, I almost say, but I catch myself. When I got my book advance, I went through this phase of special ordering my produce from a company who swore all their crops had been blessed by the Dalai Lama. We drive through astoundingly light traffic on Santa Monica, managing to make almost every traffic light. As we're gliding toward Westwood, Desmond gestures to an apartment complex down Camden Avenue. That's my building. Camden Arms, apartment 105, he answers, glancing at me with a grin. It has Tesla EV parking, in case you've got one of those. I stare at the large gleaming building. A Porsche has just pulled into the roundabout. Can most convention marketers afford such a nice place? Well, technically, it's my parents' apartment, but they're rarely there. My brother lives there, too. Stefan. He's a dabbler. Oh, what? He dabbles in many things. You'll see when you meet him. I slide closer to the window. There's no way I'm meeting Desmond's creepy brother, Stefan the dabbler. Stoplights, pedestrians, strip malls. I fill Desmond in about Leonidas and what I'd overheard at the hotel, trying hard not to give away the fact that I'd only recently relearned about Leonidas's existence. He seemed to be in cahoots with someone. Apparently, the police have been asking questions. This buoys me. Perhaps the cops had taken me seriously after all. I want to know if Leonidas was in Palm Springs that night. If he was, he could have done it. I bite down hard on my lip. I just don't know why. Was it a bad breakup?
Desmond asks. Yes, I say with near certainty, thinking of the memory of myself on the floor of the greasy-smelling pizza place and Leonidas lording over me, telling me I'd done something awful that couldn't be fixed. Did you tell your police contact about Leonidas? I explain that I've left a lot of messages on the tip line, but there's been no call back. Are you sure Lance is even a detective? Desmond asks. He could be a gossip hound. People pay big money for a scoop on an interesting person. Why would anyone want to gossip about me? Then I set my mouth in a line. I think about what Posey said. The whole world knows your story. On the other hand, Lance had shown up just 13 hours after the pool thing. He didn't know I was interesting yet. Could news travel that fast? Desmond adjusts his beret so that it sits on his head at a jaunty angle. I mean, did this Lance guy show you a badge? Something that connected him to the police department? I scratch my nose. Well, no. So you just took him at his word? I guess. Although, actually, Lance isn't a detective, per se. He's a forensic psychologist. Now Desmond looks confused. Why would they send him to talk to you? I guess he thought... I breathe out. He had this idea that maybe I had been trying to kill myself. Desmond doesn't react right away. I guess I can see how people would assume that, being that you were at the bottom of the pool. I was at the bottom of the pool because someone pushed me in and I can't swim. I know that. But why doesn't he? I sigh. Lance knew things about me before he even came into the room. And then my mother filled in the rest. The rest of what? There's no way I can get out of explaining this. I'm already in too deep. I had a brain tumor about a year ago. Desmond frowns. I'm sorry? A year ago, I had surgery. I'm better, but... He looks like he's about to cry. Oh, my sweet girl. I explain my tumor and the suicide attempts that led up to it. So my mother thinks the fall into the pool is just another one of those attempts. I guess she doesn't think I'm better. I make a face. Sometimes it feels like she almost wants me to be sick. Or maybe not sick. Maybe just contained. How so? I think for a moment. When I first attempted suicide, she did the normal stuff a mother would do. She cried, she paced, she was really concerned. But after each subsequent attempt, she started to disassociate. It was almost like she was annoyed that it kept happening, that I should just snap out of it already. She kept putting me in the hospital, and she acted pissed when I got out. And she had this whole I told you so thing going whenever I tried to drown myself again. How did she react when you were diagnosed with a tumor? I remember her marching into the nurse one day and being like, well, is she better yet? Is she cured? That sounds like she wanted you out of the hospital, not in. It was more like she was impatient. She's just so annoyed at me all the time anyway. It was like this even before the suicide stuff. She never understood me. Everything I was into, everything I said, she just recoiled. Mothers and daughters. Desmond sighs. I've always heard that's a tricky bond. Then he glances at me. Thank you for telling me. You're very brave. I squirm in my seat. There's no need for him to memorialize the moment. Then again, Desmond has a point. I haven't told anyone this much about myself or my family in a long time. Not even Kiki. Maybe it's because Desmond has no preconceived notions of me. And because I don't expect to know him after today. Or maybe it's because he sits so quietly and listens without immediately interjecting an opinion. The streets whip by. I count 3 black cars, 6 silver. Several people gawk at the Batmobile. What was the hospital like during your tumor? Desmond asks. Well, like I said, I can barely remember it. I felt drunk the whole time. Probably pumped up with morphine and other meds. All I wanted to do was sleep. I remember talking a lot, but it must have just been in dreams. When I was awake, I had no attention span, and I had splitting headaches if I didn't take my painkillers. Gracious me, Desmond murmurs. There were silent moments in my room when I was alone, and I recall staring at my hands as though I'd never seen them before. I whispered certain words to make sure I was saying them correctly. Milk, balloon, dog. They'd sounded foreign. It also felt like something had been taken from me, a big hole scooped in my brain. The tumor? I don't know. I never saw a brain scan of it. Why can't you swim? Desmond asks after a long silence. I thought every kid in California knew how to swim. Do you know how to swim? Indeed. I can even do the butterfly. Show off. I probably swam a little as a kid, but after a while I started thinking that all pools of water, or lakes or oceans, were the River Styx. I read a lot of Greek mythology. My mom had me taking swimming lessons, but I backed away from the pool every time, imagining doré etches of a creature rising out of the waves and pulling me down to hell. I never wanted to go in. I would start crying. Desmond clucks his tongue. After a while, my mother canceled the lessons. I'm sure she was embarrassed. You could take lessons now, Desmond says, unless you still think all water leads to hell. I don't. But now, water has this association. I jumped in it or ran into it or ducked under it hoping to die. It carries too much baggage. I'd rather just stay on dry land. Gotcha. Desmond taps his forehead. Mental note, do not take Eliza to any beach resorts anytime soon. He holds up a pale arm. Not that I'm partial to the beach myself. Leonidas's father's office is several blocks away. We park in the lot of the Whole Foods I'd pictured so easily. I used to stop here after school sometimes when my mother was finishing up work. I got a kick out of shoplifting fresh produce. Plums, nectarines, single cherry tomatoes. We walk along the street reading the building numbers. When we get to 1104, Desmond studies the sign for Dr. Lori and scrunches up his face. Your ex-lover is a plastic surgeon? I hate how I'm not sure. His father is. Leonidas works in reception. So what's your plan of attack? You want to access his phone, right? See who he was talking to? Where he's been? Yeah. And how are you going to do that? Well, I'm not sure. But I'm hoping you'll provide a subterfuge while I figure that out. Desmond removes his beret and runs his hand over his slick hair. Give me my instructions, he says gallantly. Say you've got an appointment. Get into the waiting room, then fake a leg injury in the hall. He'll run to your rescue, and while he's away from the desk, I'll grab his phone and look through it. Take pictures if I have to. Desmond is blinking rapidly. You want me to pretend I want plastic surgery? He looks chagrined. That's pretty much against every principle I stand for. It's not like you're going to actually get the surgery. What if someone I know sees me? I snort. You really think your gladiator cronies are going to be hanging out at a plastic surgery office? Get a grip. You'll be fine. Go in there and say you're getting calf implants. He stares at a raised leg. But my calves are fine. I've been told by quite a few ladies I have lovely calves, in fact. I shut my eyes. You know what? It's cool. We don't have to do this. I don't even know you. It was nice of you to drive me here. Desmond places his beret back on his head. No. I'll do it. I shall cast aside my preconceptions and do it for you. Seriously, Desmond, it's fine. I want to do it. It's my quest. If you're sure, I am beyond sure. But what if a man doesn't have an appointment around now? He'll know I'm up to something. You'll be faking that injury within a few seconds of getting in there, so you won't need to explain much. The front door to the building is open, and I march through, holding the door for Desmond. My muscles seem to remember the way to the suite, Perhaps I've been here before. We stop at the glass-paneled door with Dr. Lori's name on it. I peek through and see Leonidas's wobbly, freakishly tall shape at the front desk. He's leaning over a cell phone, probably the very same phone I'm going to have to intercept. I feel a pinch at the sight of him, head bent down, earbuds in. I can just imagine what he's listening to. My Chemical Romance, 311, old curmudgeonly country. I know this without knowing how I know it. I glance at Desmond. You still okay? I ask. He gives a wobbly nod. So, just go in there, say you need to use the bathroom, and do the leg thing. Which leg? I point to the right one, then change my mind and pick the left. Then I twist the doorknob for him and point into the waiting room, gesturing that he go inside. A whoosh of cold air sweeps out as Desmond pushes the door open farther. The door swishes shut again, and I press my ear to the jamb, praying another customer doesn't walk in the front door for an appointment and witness this. Then I peer through the window, my heart hammering fast. A mottled glass version of Desmond strides to the desk, and a mottled glass version of Leonidas says something. There are murmurs I can't make out, and now Desmond is going toward the waiting room. In seconds, I hear a sharp, completely over-dramatized shout from the hallway. Still, I want to kiss him for actually following through with it. Leonidas practically vaults from the front desk at the sound of Desmond's cry. He disappears from view. I count to five, then twist the handle to the door. Cool, lilac-scented air rushes in. I look to the right and left, but the waiting area is empty. Pictures of vapid-eyed women with flawless skin and enormous breasts stare at me from the walls, and across the room is a slightly pornographic shot of a woman's thighs. A few silicone breast implant samples sit on the coffee table next to a vase full of flowers. Desmond moans in the hallway.
Are you okay?
Comes Leonidas's voice.
Oh, the pain!
Desmond wails. My gaze darts to the desk. There's a computer monitor, an appointment book, a bodybuilding magazine, some forms. I spy an Android phone sitting near a dirty black messenger bag that's covered with patches for a bunch of eco-conscious action groups. I reach over the desk and grab it. The screen is still lit up from Leonidas's use, which is a boon because that means I don't have to guess at a passcode. I stare at a line of apps. Fingers shaking, I press the phone icon and navigate to received calls. Names pop up on the screen with corresponding dates and times. First, I look at his calls made and received on Saturday night when I was in Palm Springs, and even on Sunday when I was in the hospital. There are a few of them, but it's hard to know where Leonidas was when they were made. It's something I hadn't quite worked out in my head when making this plan. This phone isn't going to just give up the information. I'd need access to wireless towers, and I had no idea how the hell to get that sort of data.
You tripped over your shoe?
Leonidas is saying in the hallway. Then I try to remember the exact time I'd seen Leonidas at the cat show on Wednesday. Morning? Early afternoon? I scroll back. Numbers swim before my eyes. Some of Leonidas's callers are names he'd keyed into his contacts. Mom, Dad, someone named Bert. Other entries are just numbers. I fumble for my phone and take a picture of the whole screen of numbers, cringing at the fake click sound when the camera snaps. I do the same thing with his outgoing calls. He'd made quite a few of those, too.
Let's see if you can stand on it,
Leonidas is bellowing to Desmond.
I'll never walk again, Desmond is saying. I'm done for.
They're scuffling in the hallway. Grunts.
Up we go, Leonidas says.
I drop his phone and hurry out from behind the desk. I'm out of the office by the time he and Desmond emerge from around the corner. In the silent hall, my heart is a loud drumbeat in my ears. I breathe slowly, willing it to settle down, but it rockets on and on and on. A few moments later, the door opens.
I can call an ambulance, Leonidas is saying.
Oh, I'll make do. Desmond says weakly.
Really, it's no trouble.
Leonidas starts to say, but Desmond shuts the door in his face. He turns to me with an expression I can't quite decipher. It almost seems like he might throw up.
Let's go.
He grabs my hand and we hurry down the hall into the stairwell. Our shoes clunk noisily down the metal stairs. In the landing, we cock our heads to listen for the door above to make sure Leonidas isn't following us. All I hear is a small dog barking somewhere in the distance. In the parking lot, Desmond bends at the waist.
I just can't believe I did that. That poor kid. I lied to him. He's probably worried about me now. He's probably going to call an ambulance.
It's fine. You're fine.
And I said I was getting calf implants.
His voice is rising.
What if something happens to my calves as a sort of karmic revenge?
What, like you get calf cancer? I ask. Desmond looks horrified. I pet his arm. Don't worry. Calf cancer isn't actually a thing.
Sweat is pouring down his face. That just felt so wrong.
Get a grip. You're the one who wanted to come, and I gave you an out. I thought you'd be braver about all of this, considering you're a knight or whatever.
A Caesar.
Desmond sounds miserable. And then to himself, I can't believe I lied. We walk back to the Whole Foods parking lot in silence. I'm such an asshole for dragging him into this. Desmond unlocks the Batmobile with a shaky hand. You don't have to drive me home, I tell him. His head sweeps up.
But how will you get where you need to go?
I show him the Uber app. I'll be okay. Desmond places his hands in his pockets. An ambulance siren whoops in the distance, and I can tell he's getting worried that Leonidas is the one who's called for it. He laughs wearily.
I guess I'm just not cut out for undercover work, huh?
Nah, you did great.
You think so?
Yes, I got what I needed.
Ah, well, that's what I was here for.
We look at each other. With a hopeful smile on his face, he almost looks cute. If he shaved and had a haircut and plucked those eyebrows, the raw material is there. I don't even mind his shortness, really. And his hands, though little, are well made. Pretty even. There's something sort of endearing about his extreme worry about calf cancer. It's the sort of thing I'd worry about, too. I'm keenly aware, suddenly, of the hair whipping in my face, of how it feels like my nostrils are flaring like a bull's, and that my bra can be seen through my sweater. I can almost imagine walking over to him and wrapping my arms around his shoulders. Maybe I should. A honk cuts through the air, and we jump. Anyway, I say quietly, lowering my eyes. Thank you.
My pleasure. Desmond bows.
Let me know if you uncover any interesting information from the phone calls. I pivot, give him a half wave, and turn toward Whole Foods as though my car will be there, though you never know where Uber cars will park and how quickly they'll show up. It feels cinematic to be walking away from him. I hope that he's checking me out from behind. The air seems crisper, cleaner. I even whistle half a refrain. When I hear footsteps behind me, I assume it's Desmond, coming to spin me around and dip me into a kiss, just like Caesar and Cleopatra. I can't believe how much I want him to do this suddenly, nor can I believe how inevitable it feels. There's a hand between my shoulder blades. I twist around, ready to grin at Desmond. But the sun is in my eyes, and all I can see is a hazy silhouette that definitely isn't his. Something about the bright sun and the adrenaline and the influx of alcohol in my system makes me abruptly woozy. And as I blink at the figure in front of me, a figure still obscured by the sunlight, looming through, maybe menacing. My field of vision narrows and my legs crumple.
Oh, shit,
a voice whispers as I hit the ground, and then,
no, what the hell? Get up. Please, get up.
I roll onto my back, desperate to keep my eyes open. Someone is trying to pull me up. He or she has skinny fingers, capable arm muscles, though not particularly strong. Minty breath. Maybe hair, long hair, tickles my neck. Only before I can register what happened, My eyes flutter closed, and I pass out right there in a dingy alleyway, just out of sight of every pedestrian on Weyburn Avenue. From the Dots. After waking up to the IV in her arm, Dot knew she should tone down the drinking, lest she end up addicted. The real addiction, though, was Dorothy. Dot couldn't stop seeing her. Every Wednesday she met with her. Their evenings out were relegated to M&F, that dark little club in West Hollywood, or long limo rides around the city, taking in its glamour from behind tinted windows. Champagne flowed in the back seat of the car. Dorothy always had a flask of something. Bernie, at M&F, presented them with his best wine, and the bartender at the dark nook of a club fed them neon blue liquid straight from the bottle. Dot lapped up Dorothy's stories and attention. She beamed as Dorothy slung her arm around Dot and told her she was beautiful, amazing, funny, fantastic, the best niece a woman could ever want. But at the end of each evening, Dot blacked out, only to emerge the following day, sticky-mouthed, and slumped on the green-and-white-striped divan of Dorothy's Magnolia bungalow. Dr. Singh never returned, but Dot was haunted by the same headaches, the same disorientation, the same dread. She must just be one of those people who can't hold their liquor. "Just lie here, my dear," Dorothy said. "Rest here all day if you like." She brought Dot baskets of bread and ordered plates of eggs. She pressed cold washcloths to Dot's forehead and spent hours raking her fingers through her hair. Sometimes she just lounged next to Dot, spooning her and saying, "Oh, you don't know how good it feels to be able to take care of you." "I just wish I didn't get hungover every time we go out," Dot croaked. "Don't worry," Dorothy said hastily. "Besides, I get to take care of you. This is a treat. Thomas was taken from me when I was so young." Thomas again. Dot had so many questions, but she still thought it too indelicate to ask. Dot's boyfriend didn't go out with them after that first night. He kept using the excuse of exams and then lab work and then a fish concert he really wanted to see. "Why do I get the idea you don't want to come out with me to see Phyllis?" she finally said, aggravated. They were in the dining hall. They called Dorothy Phyllis whenever they were in public. Dot wasn't taking any chances. Her mother might have sent spies. He shrugged, trudging with his tray to the next food station. Dot followed him to the salad bar, the cereal bar, and then the froyo machine. Finally, he sighed heavily. "I wanted to be the one who took you home that night you fainted at the club. I wanted to take care of you, but she insisted. She was a bully about it, in fact." "Well, she's my aunt," Dot said. "What a silly thing to argue about. She's family." "Yeah, but do you really even know her?" Dot watched him. He was making a big deal of shoving a styrofoam cup under the yogurt dispenser. "I thought you loved her." "She's fascinating in theory, but in person, she also seemed so..." He glanced at her, then moved to the hot food line. She chased after him. "So what?" "Forget it." She watched as the cafeteria worker slopped mashed potatoes onto his tray. Her boyfriend went to sit down. He was eating mashed potatoes and froyo for dinner. He had no bearing on reality. "Are you really afraid of a 50-year-old woman?" Dot laughed. He looked up at her, mid-bite. "Just be careful, okay?" "Be careful." That one amused Dot for days. Be careful of what? Eliza. I open my eyes and sit up on the pavement, the sun baking my skin.
"Eliza,"
says a voice. I blink hard. The sun burns a harsh circle onto my retinas. A shadow appears over me, and I smell overpowering deodorant.
"You, Eliza? You call me?"
The man has on aviator sunglasses, a creased pinstriped shirt, and jeans that pull tightly across his waist. Behind him, a white Honda Pilot chugs. I look around and see the familiar buildings of the Westwood Center, the Whole Foods in particular. And it all comes back. But besides the two of us, the alley is empty. When I wince, pain explodes across my face. I touch it carefully, expecting blood, but all I feel is tenderness.
I said, you Eliza?
The man gestures to his car.
You call Uber?
Yes, I manage to say, pushing up to sit. I look around one more time. No one seems to be lurking about. But there was someone.
I've been waiting,
the man says, annoyed.
I've probably called you 6 times. I was about to leave.
I stumble to my feet and stare down at myself. All of my clothes are still on. My bag is on the ground. I grab it and rifle through it. My wallet is there. So is my phone. I touch the circle at the bottom and look at the time. Only a few minutes have passed since I looked at it last. Someone else was just here, I tell the man. Did you see? He's already walking to the Pilot.
I wasn't back here until 2 seconds ago. You want the ride or not?
He gives me a glare.
But you can't pass out again. And no puking.
I flinch. I'm not drunk.
Uh-huh.
He had something else under his breath. I don't know what to do, and my pounding head isn't making it any easier to decide. If I leave, then I'm leaving the scene of the crime. I need to call the police now, while whoever did this is still in the area. Only, if nothing was taken, was there really a crime? All of a sudden, the details feel jumbled. The sun is too hot against the crown of my head. There's a whoop, and I look up. A police car is pulling into the alleyway. Still on my ass, I watch as an officer leans out the driver's side.
We just got a call that someone fainted back here.
I whip around to the Uber driver. Did you call the police? The Uber driver holds up his hands.
No way, ma'am. I just got here.
The cop stares at us. His partner in the passenger seat peers over his Ray-Bans, then says to me,
Everything okay, miss?
My throat feels as though it's coated with corroded metal. Someone accosted me back here. I think a crime has been committed. Driver cop's gaze swings to the Uber driver. The Uber driver steps away, hands shielding his chest.
I just got here, man. You can check my GPS. I saw nothing.
It wasn't him, I say, feeling pretty confident about that. It was someone else. But something doesn't make sense. I assess the alley one more time. If I was alone when Uber Guy found me, and if Uber Guy didn't call the police saying I fainted, then who the hell did? Driver looks at his partner. Ray-Bans gives a nod. They get out of the car simultaneously, the act beautifully choreographed. Their shoes make crisp sounds as they cross the asphalt to me.
Excuse me? The Uber driver says. Can I go now?
Not yet, the cop says.
We may need you to make a statement.
The Uber driver says something in Spanish under his breath. The cop who was driving squats down and places his hands on his knees. His uniform is a crisp black. There's a shiny badge on his front pocket that says O'Hara. The name is too lilting, too poetic to belong to a police officer.
What's your name?
He asks me. Eliza.
What happened?
Ray-Bans points to my face. I touch it experimentally and wince. I can feel a bruise. I fell, I say. Someone startled me. I spun around, but I couldn't see who it was, and then I felt very woozy. After all this comes out of my mouth, I realize how flimsy it sounds. You can't arrest someone just because they come up to you and touch you on the shoulder.
Did the person say anything to you?
O'Hara asks. No, I don't think so. But at the end, after I fell, the person said, What the hell? Get up. Please.
Please.
O'Hara looks amused. He glances at his partner.
Polite.
I try to stand, but my footing feels wobbly, uncertain. I grab onto O'Hara's shoulder for balance, my mouth nearly kissing his cheek. O'Hara reaches out to steady me, and once I'm upright, I notice that his eyebrows have hitched up. His partner glances at him, a small sliver of a look. His mouth curls into a smirk.
You all right there?
O'Hara towers over me, at least 6'2". I don't know, I insist. I might have a head injury. I feel dizzy. I look at him expectantly. Neither makes a motion to write this down. There are no efforts to call an ambulance.
Well, O'Hara clears his throat. I think what you need, Eliza, is some coffee. It's possible you might have misinterpreted whoever you saw in the parking lot.
His partner, whose name tag reads Larkin, adds,
maybe they were just trying to help. Maybe they were worried about you.
My cheeks burn. I'm not drunk, I will silently. I might have a brain tumor. It's not my fault. But then I remember the mead I'd drunk before leaving Stedman's. How many shots had I taken? 2? 3? More than that? What was in mead, anyway? Was that why I was so fearless when intercepting Leonidas's phone?
We can give you a ride home, O'Hara says kindly. Or to the hospital, if you want to get checked out.
No hospitals, I say.
Can I go?
Uber driver says again.
Yeah, go ahead.
Larkin waves him away. I'm out of options. I trudge to the cruiser and slump into the back. It smells like old leather. There's some sort of paper bracelet in the footwell with the logo from a seedy strip joint. Larkin shuts the door behind me. I slump down as far as I can go in the seat. If my mother saw me now, she'd probably forcibly send me to the Oaks. I'd have no say in the matter. I swipe to unlock my phone, then press the photos button, eager to look at the picture I'd taken of Leonidas's call screen. One of the numbers on the list is needling at my memory. I know it. I just don't know why I know it. But when I access my gallery, the image is gone. I swipe and swipe, but it isn't there. I eke out, jutting my chin toward the silent figures in the front seat. O'Hara raises his eyes to me in the rear view. There was a crime, I want to say. Something was taken from me. When I was passed out, someone went on my phone and erased a photo. I tried to compose my words, but even before saying them, I know how they will sound. I will then have to explain sneaking into Leonidas's dad's office, which seems like too much of an effort, and probably not something I should be talking about. This is my punishment, I suppose, for snooping. It just doesn't seem like this punishment fits the crime. From the Dots. In mid-April, Dorothy surprised Dot by taking her to a resort. It was in the middle of the desert, and Dorothy loved it because she could hear coyotes howling all night. She got a suite for them to share. It had a large balcony that overlooked the warren-like courtyard of grassy nooks, flowering planters, and sleek wooden benches. A woman sunned herself on a towel in the nude. Dorothy turned to Dot, grinning.
There's a marvelous story about a murder at this hotel. Celebrities used to come here in the 60s, especially those who slept their way to the top. This one girl, she must have been mixed in with the wrong crowd, because someone killed her in that courtyard. Hit her over the head, and the next day, when the staff found her, they identified her as a different starlet, a more famous one. They planned this elaborate funeral for her. Friends and family from out of state came in droves. The FBI was doing a full-scale investigation. But then, the starlet emerged alive and well. Turns out, being dead for 3 days did wonders for her career. She made quite a few movies after that. Married a good friend of Sinatra's.
But what about the real murdered girl? Dot gasped. Dorothy shrugged.
Oh, I have no idea what happened to her. She probably got in over her head with some goons, and that's why they killed her.
They never figured out who did it?
No, I don't believe so. This other girl wasn't much of a priority.
Did the star who lived pay some sort of homage to her? Dot asked. I mean, it was because of this poor dead girl that her career took off, right? I hope she was grateful. A thoughtful look crossed Dorothy's features, and then she looked at Dot squarely. You know what would be interesting? If the famous starlet was actually the one in trouble with the goons in Palm Springs, but she sent this other girl in her place to bear their wrath. She got out of a jam and a career boost. Lucky thing. Huh? Oh, don't listen to me. She playfully slapped Dot's arm. I'm just making up a plot. When they went to the bar, Dorothy wore her sunglasses and scarf. Why don't you want anyone to notice you? Dot asked as her aunt checked herself out in the mirror. Dorothy's mouth made a straight line. I just don't want to answer questions. Questions about what? I wear many hats, Dot. I have my hands in many pies. Someone started playing a piano, an old-timey 20s tune with lots of trills and flourishes. Why does my mother hate you? Dot blurted. Dorothy grew still. Is that what she said? That she hates me? Dot didn't answer. Dorothy's head drooped. She made a clucking sound with her tongue. We used to be good friends, marvelous friends, especially growing up. I mean, we didn't see each other much, but there was still a bond, you know. I was always the pretty one, but I was unlucky in love. Your mother's husband, your father, he was a peach, a good man. Took care of her and you. He lived in Los Angeles, which is why you all moved there. I moved to follow you. I bet you didn't know that. Dot shook her head. She did not. But your mother is... Well, you know her. She didn't give your father what he needed. I was over a lot. I could tell what was happening to their marriage. I saw him looking at me, too. I tried to ignore it. But I had needs, too. I'd just gotten divorced. I'd just lost Thomas. I was single and rich and miserable. I only kissed him once, but your mother caught us. She banished me from then on. Said I was no longer her sister. You kissed my father? No, darling. He kissed me. But he wasn't a bad man. Please don't think that. It just happened. Sometimes things do. But anyway, your mother read it how she wanted to read it. I was the instigator, she thought. We didn't speak for a time. I think she understood what I meant to you and what you meant to me. She always knew how I could help out, financially. So she agreed that you and I could still visit. But she made it clear she wasn't happy with me. I did everything in my power to win your mother back. After your father passed away, your mother found out he had bad debts and no life insurance policy. She really did work like a dog to keep you two afloat. I said I'd help out, but she wouldn't accept my money. Dorothy paused to sip. Your mother is very proud. Dot widened her eyes. So Dorothy had offered to help out. She curled her fist under the table. From then, things started to fall apart between us again, Dorothy explained. She enjoyed working, and she made excuses to work. But I think she sensed it wasn't right. The guilt weighed on her. She took it out on me. She was jealous of our relationship, yours and mine. I could do for you what she couldn't. Did she send you away? Dot cried. Dorothy stared at the table. Slowly, she licked her lips. I don't want to drive a wedge between you, dear, she said softly. Dot snorted. The wedge was already there. Mom says you're unwell. A muscle in Dorothy's cheek twitched. She took Dot's hands and looked at her hard. Her eyes were so clear and violet. What do you think? Do you think I'm unwell? No, Dot answered, But then she thought of what her boyfriend had said, that Dorothy was a bully. How much do you know about her? Why was he so mistrusting? A group of boys about Dot's age passed through the bar just then. Dot watched them carefully. They were bearded, dirty, their jeans cut skinny, their shoes carefully weathered. They were probably coming from the three-day concert that was taking place the next town over. It was the kind of concert where you camped out and took a lot of drugs. Dot and Marlin had thought about going, but then had decided not to because neither of them had anything appropriate to wear. The boys slunk up to the guests in the bar and whispered in their ears. They were targeting other young people, it seemed. And each person they asked frowned, digested their question, then shook their heads. Finally, the boys made their way to Dot. But when they noticed Dorothy was older, they started to move on. "Wait," Dorothy cried. The boys turned. "You guys either have something or are looking for something. Which is it?" Dot nudged her. "What are you doing?" Dorothy's gaze was still on the group. "I'm not a cop, fellas. I'm honestly curious." The boys shifted their weight, stuck their hands in their pockets. They all exchanged a glance, then shrugged. "We have a bunch of flaca." The shortest and dirtiest one, his dreadlocks literally caked with mud, said. "We're looking for takers." "What's flaca?" "Not for you," the tallest one said quickly. "How do you know?" Dorothy asked. Dot stared at her in horror. The boy in the middle, who was the one most normal-looking, his brown hair only a little shaggy and his face clean-shaven, shrugged. "It's kind of like ecstasy, and it's kind of like a roofie, except not as dangerous." His friends nudged him and gave him sharp looks. "What?" he murmured to them. "She asked." "It's not like she knows what a roofie is, dude." Dirty Dreadlocks spat. Dorothy scoffed. "I know what a roofie is, boys. And sure, we'll take some." "No, we won't," Dot cried. Dorothy was already getting out some cash. Dot looked around frantically, paranoid someone in the bar was going to be wise to their drug deal. The police would come, Dorothy would go to jail, and Dot would somehow be implicated. And then her mother would find out. It was over quickly, though. The exchange fluid and discreet. The boys slunk away. The biggest one's dreadlocks bounced cheerfully. They all had slow, dumb laughs. Dot wondered if they were already high. She turned to Dorothy. "What are you trying to prove?" "Nothing," Dorothy said haughtily. "Oh, well, maybe a little. I was teaching them not to be so ageist. Sometimes women in their early 50s like to party, too." Dot stared at the pocket where Dorothy had slipped the pills. "It's not like you're going to take those, are you?"
"I don't know. Maybe."
She drained the last of her singer.
"Don't worry, dear. It'll be someday when you're not around. A random afternoon when I'm feeling lonely."
"Then I'll have to stick by you every day," Dot said. "Make sure you don't ever take it. It might kill you." Dorothy's face brightened.
"Darling, that would be absolutely lovely if you stuck by my side every single day."
Back at home, Dot told Marlin the story. She told it in a joking way. "My crazy aunt, isn't she a card?" She told him after they'd had sex, when he was in a good mood. But Marlin paled.
"Shit," he said in a far-off voice. "I'd never even thought of that."
"What?" Dot asked, sitting up. "What are you talking about?"
"Roofies. Maybe she's drugging you."
Dot barked out an angry laugh.
"I can't believe you'd say such a thing."
"I keep working it out in my head, Dot. That night when we went out with her, you really hadn't had much. There had to be something else in the mix. Something that made you pass out like that."
"My aunt loves me," Dot cried. "She wouldn't roofie me. Take it back."
He threw up his hands. "I didn't want to tell you this, but but I looked up some facts about the Otufu story. Where your aunt visited is fairly stable. There are no warlords.
So what? She got her story mixed up.
Or maybe she was making all of it up. I talked to my grandparents, too. They said she was a real nut. Used to walk around the Magnolia grounds naked. Don't ever swim in her bungalow's pool. She used to have orgies in there. He made a face.
Doc got up from the bed and pulled on her sweatshirt. You were asking around about her? What gives you the right?
I was just asking some questions. I want to protect you.
Doc glared at him. Even if all of this is true, does that make her a bad person? A person who'd roofie someone?
I don't know. Maybe.
I can't believe you're saying this.
She stepped into her underwear and jeans, grabbed her backpack, and headed toward the door.
Call me when you grow up.
Come on, don't be like that. Don't kill the messenger.
Dot stared into the grungy dorm hallway. I think we should break up.
Dot, I love you. I'm not saying this to hurt you.
Dot shut her eyes. She knew he did. But why couldn't he love Dorothy? Why was he trying to undermine her?
Please, don't go out with her anymore, Marlin said. Just for a little while. Just until we can figure out what's true and what's not.
Dot stared at the door that led to the hall. There was a thin beam of fluorescent light poking through the peephole. I can't do that.
Behind her, he sighed. His hands moved away from her. She could feel his heat recede.
She flung open the door and ran, a ball lodged in her throat. She ran down the hall and entered the little nook that held the dorm's vending machines, wedged herself between the Pepsi machine and the ice maker, and rested her head between her knees for a long, long time. Eliza. Monday morning, I start awake, disoriented. Where am I? A hazy scene around me, green and white striped curtains, a luxurious California king bed. But then the furniture turns to mist. I open my eyes, and I'm in my canopy bed in my bedroom. Where else would I be? Someone pounds on the door. Judging by the lack of noises to right the situation, I'm guessing Kiki and Stedman aren't home. I sit up slowly, a sticky, rotting taste in my mouth. There's one message on my phone from Laura.
I got this weird voicemail from this woman who said she's your mother. She wants us to not publish your book?
Nothing from my mother, though. I don't know why I'm even checking. Nothing from Bill, apologizing for her. Nothing from Lance, the forensic psychologist. Nothing from Richie, the bartender. More pounds. I glance in the mirror at myself and try to tamp down my wild, witch-like hair. Mascara is caked around my eyes, and I must have reapplied lipstick in between drinks number 7 and 8, because it makes a wobbly circle around my general mouth region, hitting a good bit of my teeth, too. The knot on my head where I fell on Friday has morphed over the weekend from a garish blackish purple to an even uglier greenish yellow. It still hurts when I touch it. I dart into the bathroom and scrub my face raw. With the makeup gone, my eyes are tiny, my lips puffy, my cheeks the color of raw cauliflower. I smooth my hair down my forehead and arrange it so it's kind of covering up the bruise. I down 20 varieties of vitamins in hopes that their wonder powers will counteract all the alcohol. Then I take a deep breath and listen, hoping the knocking has ceased. If anything, whoever it is has begun to pound harder. What if it's Leonidas down there? What if he knows I'm alone and has come to hurt me for looking through his phone? I part the curtain at the top of the stairs and peer out the window. The Batmobile is in the driveway. I'm so astonished that I laugh. I would have thought that after Friday, Desmond would want to be rid of me. I hurry down the stairs and open the door. I find him in a disarmingly normal black t-shirt, old black jeans, and lace-up boots that are suede and pointed and perhaps like something a minstrel might wear. He cocks his head at me.
Were you slumbering?
No, but I was sleeping, I mutter. I tossed and turned all night. Up solving your mystery. You should have